Hi everyone, how are you? Nice to see you back. Today we transition, we journey toward the shores of North Africa and Spain. And as you'll see, I mean that quite literally, not that we're going to be doing some journeying, but we'll be talking about shores and journeys in just a few moments. Before we open up a conversation about a really foundational text that that marked this transition, at least in the perspective of sort of the collective memory of Jewish history. Before that, I want to just, as we transition from the Gaonic period in Babylonia, to now begin to look at some of the personalities, in particular in North Africa, before we transition to the Jewish community in Spain. And again, this is primarily really the transition of the Sephardic medieval community. So as the Jews moved to North Africa, and they're in communities such as Fez in Morocco, or Kairouan, which we'll discuss as well, really just the northern tip, really, or that area of Africa. And then we'll look at, before we sort of take that step back, to look at a couple of specific personalities who really shape the transmission of our Mesorah, and a couple of people in particular. I want to look at two: Rabbeinu Chananel and the Rif. Hmm. Two really anakim, real titans in Jewish history, in particular the Rif, but Rabbeinu Chananel as well. So a quick background: Rabbeinu Chananel, we don't have too much biographic information. He passes away mid 11th century, so just give a sense of the time that we are. We said the Gaonic period runs roughly 700 to 1000, probably a little bit later than 1000, but at that point already it starts to peter out. The historical context for the decline of that community is not entirely clear. There's some amount of tension with the local rulers, but it's not 100% clear what the factors that lead to the decline of that community are. Certainly there's just a sense that the Torah leadership and scholarship is no longer found in places such as Baghdad as it was previously. Certainly the stature of the classic yeshiva of Surim Pampadisa is not what it once was. But for whatever range of reasons, really, the community starts to shift, and the center of the intellectual vibrancy of Jewish life really begins to move. So Rabbeinu Chananel passes mid-11th century. There's a possibility, interestingly enough, although we don't know for sure, that he was born in Rome, in Italy, which is interesting. So he's not quite making that transition that we spoke of. He makes his way to a community, I think it's still in existence, you can check it up on Google Maps, called Kairouan. Kairouan is one of, probably alongside Fez, one of the best known communities from this period, not particularly well known, I think, in the larger arc of Jewish history, but if we're just examining with a microscope this time, and it's a particularly relevant, prominent community. And really, in many ways, Rabbeinu Chananel serves as a bridge between the Babylonian Gaonic tradition and moving toward the North African / Spanish Jewish community. Now, a couple of things to note. First, Rabbeinu Chananel is well known to us when we learn Gemara. Mm-hmm. He appears on the side of the page on most printed Vilna Shas, so most Masechtos of Shas, not all, but most. And so, for example, I just pulled off randomly off my shelf Masechet Shabbat, and if you take a look, you have the Gemara in the middle. The inside margin is, of course, Rashi. The outside is Tosos. And then flanking Tosos, literally on the outside, outer margin of the page, appears the commentary of Rabbeinu Chananel, running commentary, which he essentially summarizes the major practical points of the sugya. Sometimes he'll add a comment or two of his own. And so it's a commentary that is written on the Bavli, which continues a tradition which had begun in the time of the Gaonim, but begins to harden in the time of the Rishonim, such that the Talmud Bavli is considered to be the most foundational text vis-a-vis the Talmud Yerushalmi. Remember, when they were both written, it wasn't obvious that the Bavli would supersede the Yerushalmi. That's something that we take for granted from a 21st century perspective. It wasn't necessarily obvious. The fact that his commentary is specifically written on the Talmud Bavli, I think, is telling. And yet, Rabbeinu Chananel, interestingly enough, relies relatively heavily on the Yerushalmi. So in his commentary, it's sort of a dialectic here. On the one hand, he's preferring the Bavli, if only by the fact that his commentary is written on the Bavli, and yet he will very often cite the Yerushalmi and say, the Yerushalmi says this. He may not even add a comment. He might just quote the Yerushalmi, FYI. He may comment the Yerushalmi disagrees. He may elaborate, he may not. But he often introduces the Yerushalmi. Now, another aspect of his approach to comment, his commentarial approach, is that very often Rabbi Yochanan will focus on practical takeaways from the Gemara. It's not interested, it's not like reading a Tosot. Tosot is asking this question and that question, and how does this Gemara fit with that other random Gemara, and how do I split hairs in order to resolve them? The Derech HaLimud of the Baalei HaTosfot, more, we wouldn't call it pilpul nowadays, but much more analytical, and on the basis of comparing between divergent texts and very often trying to find some resolution. Rabbi Yochanan is really not doing very much of that. A little bit, but really very little. He's focused on the daf, on the page, but in that sense he's similar to Rashi, right? Except that Rashi's focus is just a running elaboration on the Gemara itself. Rashi's focus is on what this Gemara means. Sometimes Rashi will ask from here, will ask from there. Sometimes Rashi will give some practical halacha, but that's not at all the thrust of Rashi and Rashi's tradition. Rabbi Yochanan is similar to Rashi, and in that sense Rashi, of course, Ashkenazi, is similar in that it's a running commentary which focuses on the simple pshat of the Gemara. It's not asking all these questions from everywhere, but it diverges from Rashi and many of the other Ashkenazic commentators that we're going to circle back to later on in the year, in as much as Rabbeinu Hananel's focus really is on practical halacha. Lach l'masa, what do we do? And this is going to become especially important when we come to the riff in just a few moments, but just to make the point now, if we think about the differences between the Ashkenazic and Sephardic approaches writ large, to be a little bit simplistic, but I think I think it's a very fair generalization. The Ashkenazic tradition, especially after the Baalei HaTosfot, who introduced the notion of dialectic and asking all these questions and the back and forth and the sophisticated kinds of distinctions that they draw, the chilukim, etc., the Sephardic tradition was traditionally more pshat-oriented and more practical-oriented. Halacha l'masa, what do we do? Rabbi Yochanan is an extremely important anchor for that tradition, which then finds itself really, in certain ways, at its height in the commentary of the Rif. The Rif becomes, in many ways, a foundational Sephardic text in this regard. Now, of course, we're going to get there a little bit later. In the Sephardic community, in Christian Spain, as we'll get to, there's after the Reconquista of Spain, which we're going to come to. So at that point already, you have Sephardic commentaries who have influence from Christian Ashkenazim, because there is a shared culture there. So when we come to personalities such as the Ramban, Nachmanides, and others as well, they already start to integrate between Rabbeinu Hanan on the Rif's more simple halacha pshat kind of approach and the Baalei HaTosfot's dialectical, analytical kind of a perspective, and there's sort of a meeting of these two streams, these two traditions. But at this point, they're relatively distinct. You have the North African and Spanish commentaries are not asking, they're not asking questions from here and from there and from everywhere. They're much more focused, right? Some would say they're narrow, right? Those who are dismissive, those who are critical of this approach. And others would say that they take a very simple, straightforward, a sort of clear-minded approach without all the distractions that get us, you know, kind of excited but you know, distracted. We just kind of focus on what's most important. Of course, this focus on the simple pshat in terms of, and that focus on halacha, of course, has had a modern resurgence. And it's not just sort of a Avad Yosef, that's where it's most famously known in our generation, but many other Sephardic poskim, really not as inclined as the Ashkenazim to the pilpuls, to the fancy analysis. If you put Rav Avadya's Tshuvos alongside Rav Moshe Feinstein's, they're substantially different in this regard. Both brilliant, each in its own way, but in a different kind of sense. Rav Avadya knows everything, sees everything, and crystallizes for us what is, in his opinion, sort of the straight consensus reading of the sugya. Rav Moshe sometimes will say, right, well, it's true that the Shach and the Bach and all the classic Achronim said one thing, but I read the Sugya, and I think Rashi read it differently. So I'm going to paskin in a completely different way. So Rav Moshe will really throw us for a loop, and you'll read it, and either you'll agree with his analysis, you'll disagree. But the point is, Rav Moshe is much more independent in that kind of way, and much more creative. Some would say, well, that's what a posik needs to do. Mm-hmm. Others will say, actually, if there's been an overwhelming tradition of how to read the sugya in sort of a straightforward kind of way, what are you getting so foolish on me, and you're complicating things too much, right? There's a very sort of straight and narrow reading of the sugya that we need to be attentive to. So these different, these two streams sort of meet at one point, but then at later points in history diverge once again, and then you have this real sense of pride in these different traditions that manifests itself culturally in many of the ways that we see until today. So really, Rabbeinu Chananel is well known because he's here, highly influential in particular, as we'll see in context of the Rif, but it should also be mentioned that he's sharing and building upon many traditions of the Gaonim, who also were practically oriented. We pointed out earlier that they would come together to study 2 months of the year to analyze practical halachic questions and to issue rulings to the community. The modern notion of she'ilug tshuva literature, what we call the responsive literature, really finds itself, as it's developed, evolves primarily during the period of the Gaonim. So it sort of starts with communities asking questions, and then you have this focus on determining the practical halacha, and then that seems to evolve in other Sephardic contexts later on as we move to North Africa and Spain to sort of just a focus. Now we turn the Bavli. The Bavli has become the established text. The canon is really set and widespread and becomes an object of full-fledged study in its own right. The Gaonim to some extent, but really at this later period to an even greater extent. And so when they turn to write commentaries on the Talmud Bavli, it's with an eye toward sort of the practical, straightforward rendering of the sugya. Mm-hmm. That's Rabbeinu Chanana. And then we have also some others. There's, for example, Rav Nissim Gaon, who's called the Gaon, but doesn't quite fit the... he's closer to the Gaonic period than the Vilna Gaon, so the Vilna Gaon was already 1,000 years away from the Gaonim. So that's, if you think about it, I've done this with students, not here, students know, but I've asked students, you know, tell me the name of the Gaon, you know, who lived between the 7th, you know, around the 8th, 9th, 10th century, they'll always say first, the Vilna Gaon, right? Which, it's the same word, but that's kind of where it ends. Rabbeinu Gaon, not quite the same. Also appears on the page in some of the Gemarot, may have spent some time in Baghdad and then North Africa, a primary student of Rabbeinu Chananel, and also continuing this tradition. Rabbeinu Chananel. In continuing this tradition, there are others as well. So, for example, here on the bottom of the page in Shabbat, he appears on much fewer Masechta, but you have in the bottom here of Nisim Gaon as well. So he makes his way onto the page of the Gemara. Figuring out, obviously they didn't necessarily figure this out in their lifetimes, but figuring out how to appear on the page or even in the back, right? That's how you make it, I guess, if you want to say it that way. It is interesting that in later periods in Jewish history, there were commentaries that were specifically intentionally written on a text that was oft studied in that particular community or at that particular time, so that people could actually increase the readership. So, for example, some of the classic achronim on topics of monetary law, the Sos HaChoshen, the Sivos HaMishpat, some of the outstanding achronim that are written on topics in monetary law, really they're standalone works, and really they could have been published as independent Lumdisha Svarim, but they weren't. They were written as commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, probably because that's what everyone was learning. So if you print a brilliant work as a standalone, it might not be used, but if it finds its way into the printed editions of the Shulchan Aruch, then you've got it made. And if you can actually have an arrangement with the printer to have your Sefer printed in, right, if you can arrange for that, Matovu Mana'im. So in order to, there are those who did it intentionally, Rav Nissim Gaon, Rabbeinu Chananel, not at all, But very often, whoever's printed on the canonical text ends up very much staying with us, whether that's some sort of siyata deshmaya or just, you know, luck of the draw. You know, I guess only he knows, but it is what it is. So that's Rabbeinu Chananel. Of course, now we'll turn to the Rif. Rif living in Morocco. He's living in Fez, Morocco. I don't know, one of the more memorable names. Fez. And that's who you can check up on Google Maps. The Rif lives just about 90 years. He's born in 1013. He passes in 1103. So 11th century, essentially. He's a student of Rabbeinu Chananel and Rav Nissim Gaon in Kairouan. Rabbeinu Chananel dies sometime in the mid 11th century. So they're clearly overlapping. If the Rif is born in 1013 and Rabbeinu Chananel dies sometime 1040s, 50s, 60s, 70s, something like that. So there's some substantial overlap in among his student, Rabbi Yochanan's student, Nissim Gaon, as well. And then eventually he comes to Fez. He writes his classic commentary to the Gemara after learning as many students who surround him. He has some sort of yeshiva. Again, it would be fascinating to learn a little bit more about how these yeshiva were structured and how they work. We just don't have that much information. It's unfortunate. But what we do know is that what emerged from his learning and from those circles is his commentary called the Commentary of the Rif, Ravinu Alfasi. And the Rif is printed in the back of all the practical areas of Shas, which is the solid majority of the Talmud Bavli. So it does not appear, for example, on Zvachim, right? And it only appears in Zvachim's Korbanos. It wasn't practical at that time. Menachos also, flower offerings in the Beit HaMikdash were primarily not practical. There are sections in Menachot in which we learn about the halachot of mezuzot, tefillin, sifrei Torah, etc. Tzitzit. Those areas, the Rif does have a running commentary. So depending on what the discussion is about and the topic, he will or will not have a commentary. And he may just focus on what was most practical. That already is a clue as to the interest and the focus of the Rif. Of course, continuing the tradition of Rabbeinu Hanan. And that indeed is the major thrust of his commentary. Essentially what the Rif does, it's sort of a Gemara digest. It's like a Bavli that cuts to the chase, that cuts out, you know, we read the Bavli. So, right, you've got this one has this opinion, that one has that, and this one has this question, that one has that question, the whole back and forth, and the whole complicated analysis. Now, some people think this is the greatness of the Bavli, right? So if you ask me, I love this stuff, right? It's just that, you know, I thrive on the back and forth. And there are others who say, like, new tachlis, right? What's the halacha here, right? The Bavli is like, you know, it's like you're there. Some say that the Yushalmi, and I think this is not a coincidence, the Yushalmi, some say, Ruf Cook, for example, claim that the Yushalmi is much more straight, much more practical. All this, you know, in the intellectual acrobatics, like, get rid of it. And the Ruf Cook actually says that he, in a sense, he prefers the Yushalmi to the Bavli. He develops this whole idea of Torat Eretz Yisrael, and that there's a certain bihirut, the Gemara has a certain clarity of thought that's associated with Torah that's studied in Israel, and develops this whole notion that on the basis of the Gemara, for example, says that Avira the Ari Yisrael Machkim, that the heir of Israel somehow lends a greater sense of intelligence. For Ruf Cook, it's not just that you're smarter and you can say an even fancier set of Lamdish analysis and Pilpanoth, just the opposite. It's bihirut, it's clarity, it's straightforward thinking. Ruf Cook claims that the Yerushalmi has this much more than the Bavli. It's, of course, not a coincidence that the Yerushalmi is relatively unedited, whereas the Bavli was much more elaborate and worked on by more hands. On the one hand, that means the Yerushalmi is much more difficult to make out. It's hard to read. But there aren't as many overlays in terms of the analysis. Obvious than that, you know, the more hands you have working at something, typically, not always, but unless they're right, really cutting everything left and right, often you'll have more. It might be richer, but it might just be more. I think the Bavli is richer and more. So there are those who claim that the Yerushalmi has that sense of clarity, and I think so it's perhaps not a coincidence, if that's the case, that Rabbeinu Hanan and the Rif, who are interested in the practical halacha, tend to include the Yerushalmi. Even as they're commenting on the Bavli as the primary text, that's already sort of a given in circles of Torah scholarship, still they tend to introduce the Yerushalmi, which the Rif does as Rabbeinu Hanan relatively often, and also just focusing on the practical takeaway. The Rif's commentary became so renowned, it really got to the point that the Rif was, in some yeshivot, shortly after his life, was the primary text of study. So you'd walk into yeshiva, and you would look at, right, or you're sending your kids off to yeshiva, and you would look at their, right, at their classes, and you would see that their Judaic classes would have something like, right, they'd have Chumash and Navi or whatever, and instead of learning Gemara class or a Talmud class, they'd have Rif. They'd learn Rif. And for exactly this reason, they don't have to learn all the intellectual acrobatics. I mean, Shas goes on forever. We need to know what to do. Now, you could say, okay, well, we'll just give a digest of really, and then you'd be shorn of the entire context. So the Rif is sort of a middle path. And there are many Sephardic yeshivot in which at that time, shortly after the life of the Rif, this became not just a critical text, the primary text, and almost displaced the Bavli to a certain degree in many courses of study. which is, of course, somewhat controversial, but is exactly what happened. And it's already in the lifetime of the Rif, it would seem, that this already began to take place. And he became so renowned after this text because, again, he, right, didn't make it on the page of the Gemara. He replaced the page of the Gemara, right? That's already a cut above. That's why, by the way, if you look at the structure of the Rif, it's for this reason, right? You really get the Rif is, it appears in our Vilna Shas just like the Gemara. The Gemara has, right, you have the inside margin is Rashi, then the outside margin you have Tosfot. So the Rif looks, it's just you go to the back of the Gemara, and the middle is the Rif, right? So it's structured. The physical layout is just like the Gemara. You have Rashi on the inside margin, right? There's some question. It's not exactly the same text as the other Rashi. So the question is, what's this Rashi? So the exciting explanation, that's unfortunately historically probably untrue, or almost certainly untrue, but there are those who wanted to say that this is actually not by Rashi, but of course, Rashi's daughters. Historically, it's probably not accurate. Probably what happened is this is an earlier recension of Rashi's commentary to the Gemara, which appears, which was reprinted here in context of the Rif, and they only reprint the lines that appear in the Rif, so that's why it's also much shorter and to the point, because it was sort of cut, cut out. Rashi worked on his commentaries throughout the course of his life, constantly editing them. He probably had notebooks from earlier students of that same tradition, so Rashi's constantly revising his work. So you have Rashi on the inside, and then you have, instead of Tos on the outside, you have on most Masechtos, and then you have Rabbeinu Nissim, not the same Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon, but rather Rabbeinu Nissim of Girona, 13th century Spanish Rishon, we'll come back to later on. So, but you have essentially a similar thing. In some commentaries, you have another Spanish Rishon, some Masechtos, you have Nimuke Yosef. If you take a look, at various Masechtos, there are sometimes different commentaries printed here. On Masechet Brachot, it would be Talmidei Rabbeinu Yonah. But note, these are all Rabbeinu Yonah is also a Spanish 13th century Rishon. So these are all essentially 14th century Sephardic commentaries that were printed together with the Rif, almost as if to say the Rif is its own Gemara, as it were, flanked by Rashi on the one side and the equivalent of a Tosvos, right, with a Sephardic twist, basically, whether it be Rabbeinu Nissim or the others. So you have really this kind of layout, right? And again, if you just opened it up and we didn't know any better, I just kind of glanced at the page, it sure looks like a Gemara to me. I've had this with students. We'll just open up and they're like, I can't find it. I'll be like, we're on Daf Hey Omid Beis, and they're like, Rabbi, it's just not there. And, you know, figure out, no, they opened up to the Rif. And so there's really a lot of that. So the Rif.
What's the last one? Sorry, Rabbeinu Yonah, did you say?
There's Rabbeinu Yonah on Brachot, yeah. Taller Tamide Rabbeinu Yonah. So he's Rabbeinu Yonah also from Girona, also in the 13th century Spanish Rishon. Very prominent as well. So the Rif becomes famed in his life, and in fact, to the point that at around age 75, in 1088, so remember, he passes in 1103, he lives to around 90 years old. So he's done quite well for himself. He's getting 75 years old. He's forced to flee Spain, which has to do with some of the violence. Again, we don't have such clear records, but seems to have been substantial anti-Semitism, violence, etc. in some of these communities that really forced them now to go to Spain. And in 1088, he goes to Cordoba, which is one of the centers of Jewish life at that time. And then he eventually settles in Lucena, which is another community there. And almost immediately upon his arrival in 1089, he's appointed the Rosh Yeshiva of Lucena, and they shower him with, you know, all sorts of pomp and circumstance. Remember we saw the appointment of the exile, that kind of ceremonial reception, the Rosh Yeshiva, and so on and so forth. And he lives there for the last 14 or so years of his life as a celebrated Agadol Hador. So the Rif really becomes the major dominant personality for the Sephardic Rishonim, and it's not just reflected in the structure of the page, but also in some of the commentaries that are written in defense of the Rif. So for example, as we're familiar later on, we have on the bottom, I have it here as well, printed in many Gemarot, you have the debates between, sometimes quite vociferous debates between two great scholars. Their commentaries are known as the Baal HaMa'or, on the one hand, and the Mechamos Hashem. So these are authored, respectively, the Baal HaMa'or, the Master of Light, is authored by Rav Zerachya HaLevi. Zerachya HaLevi is living somewhat about 100 years later or so. He's living in Provence in southern France. He's not necessarily a very well-established scholar, but a rising star. He writes a series of commentaries that are critical of the Rif. He calls it Baal HaMa'or. He's just coming to offer enlightenment. And so that's the commentary that he writes. So there's a slew of Svardic Rishonim who come to the defense of the Rif, because what the Baal HaMa'or is doing is essentially it's a critique of the Rif. Comes along the author of the Mechanos Hashem, the Wars of God, just the language itself gives you a sense, right? This is a holy war, and this is a defensive holy war. Right? This is self-defense, and this is written by none other than the Ramban, by Nachmanides himself, one of the great Sephardi Rishonim of all time. And he comes to the defense of not his immediate Rebbe, but of his Rebbe in the larger sense of the term. And he writes a Sefer Mechamos Hashem, defending the Rif from, I think, every single one of the Baal HaMa'or's printed attacks on the Rif. Not one goes unanswered by the Ramban. And so he takes the time to write an entirely new commentary simply to defend the Rif from the attacks of this what he essentially calls a young whippersnapper by the name of Zerachya HaLevi, who came along and thought that he had the capacity to disagree with the Gadol Shebegadolim, the Rif, and who does this guy think he is? And so it gets a little bit colorful, as you sometimes find among the Rishonim, which they get animated and they throw around some strong language about Hebel and such things. And it gets a little bit fun at times, but the sense of reverence for the Rif, you're gonna take on the Rif? Who do you think you are? It's in Spartic circles. That's really who the Rif was. He's just a towering figure. And it wasn't true in the Ashkenazi community in the same way, but in the Sephardi community in Spain, that's really how it was. That's the sense of the reverence that they had. The Rif, also interesting, has about 320 some odd surviving responsa. You can find them if you have access at all to get access to the Bar Ilan CD. They're printed there. You can find them. Some interesting contemporary tshuvot, and some of his students, because he was so renowned, they preserved some of his classical texts and responsa. So he has, just to give one example of a classic position which does not appear in his tshuvot, or it emerges, it fits nicely with his commentary on the Gemara, but he doesn't go so far as to say it explicitly. There's a very interesting question with regard to blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it falls out on Shabbat. We know that our practice is not to do so. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara with a range of different opinions among the Tanaim as to under what circumstance we might convene a Beit Din that would enable us to blow the shofar. It's clear in the Sugyot that there is a requirement for a Beit Din of a certain stature in order to be able to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, that the reason is, let's assume for the sake of argument, which is what the Bavli says, that there's no inherent bar, it's not a biblical halacha, it's not min haTorah to suspend the shofar, rather it's a rabbinic concern that you might come to carry. And so therefore Chazal said, we don't blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. People are going to come to violate in Isser Del Rite of carrying out the Erev and Shabbat, so they suspended the blowing of the shofar. However, if there is a responsible Beit Din of a certain kind of stature, so then maybe there could be room to explore such a possibility. Now, for us, in our experience, that doesn't really happen. We don't do that. But there were moments in Jewish history where there were people who thought that maybe they had such a Beit Din of such stature that maybe they could blow the shofar. Now, it has to do also with the sugya. There are those who say you need a full-fledged Sanhedrin, and if you pass in that way, that there is much less to talk about. The others who say that you need a Beit Din of 23, and still then it would be harder to pull off. But if you say 3 or 20 or something like that, but not necessarily that it has to be like the official smicha Sanhedrin that has, you know, ishmi piish, the heritage, you know, one getting it, receiving the Mesorah from the smicha from generation after generation, then maybe you could reconstitute such a Beit Din. So there is a story of the Rif that one year, I think in Lutzena, it might have been in Fez, I don't remember where he was actually, but there's a story recorded by his student that one year the Rif convened such a Beit Din and felt that with his stature and their stature, they were able to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and then that's apparently what happened. So it's recorded by some outstanding sources. I don't know if anyone else in that generation agreed, but it was the Rif. So if it was the Rif, they may have not agreed or done so in their local community, but if you're the Rif, then you know, you have the right to your opinion. There have been modern attempts to reconstitute a Sanhedrin on Rosh Hashanah Shechel Yot B'Shabbat, and it's been some stories. There are a couple of attempts. There's an attempt about 100-some-odd years ago by a Rabbi Akiva Schlesinger, who was a prominent Haredi rabbi/activist in advocating for the Yishuv HaYashan around the time the kibbutzim were moving into Israel, and he advocated for the Chazon Ish's type community, for the Haredim, and there was a story surrounding him, the possibly blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, and then I believe that there's a story told about Rav Steinsaltz as well. He has attempted to pull this off, which, if you know about Rav Steinsaltz, might not be so surprising. I'm not certain that he's actually done it, but that's what they say. Sometimes an interesting psak, but be that as it may, that's really his very substantial legacy. Interestingly enough, he had a number of outstanding students. One of them is the Rimi Gash. The Rimi Gash is the grand rebbe of the Rambam. He was the Rambam's father's teacher. The Rambam studied with his father. The Rambam did not have too many teachers. His life did not allow him to sit in a traditional yeshiva. He was too busy running from radical terrorists, for lack of a better term. That's all we usually call them, but you get the idea. So the Rambam studies with his father. His father's Rebbe was the Rimi Gash, who in turn was a student of the Rif. So there's that piece, which is going to be interesting for the Rambam. Also intriguing in a different sense is that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi studied with the Rif as well, which is not necessarily what typically think about Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. We think of him as a poet, as a philosopher, which he certainly was. He learned with the Rif as well, and the Rif not known as a poet or a philosopher. And yet there was that connection as well. So he has a substantial influence moving forward, but I think even more than any particular student, although there was certainly that as well, it's just the sense of him being the towering personality, halachic personality, of the Spanish Jewish community and the kind of influence that had. Okay, so those are just a couple of the prominent rabbinic personalities at this time. Now, what I want to do now is to transition a little bit to what exactly happened here in terms of this movement from community to community, but not historically, because truth is that the history is shrouded in some mystery. But I want to focus not so much on what historians can piece together as the actual facts that happened, and I want to focus a little bit more on sort of the collective memory of our community with regard to the story. I don't mean to say because it's a collective memory, therefore it's untrue, but I mean to say a little bit of a different focus. When we think about memory as opposed to history, there's a lot of that, especially in medieval Jewish history, a lot of sort of meditating on around the Crusades and history and how we make meaning of history. There's a lot there, and there's been a lot of conversation about that. I want to share a story. I'm sharing with you just a part of the text. It's a text called The Four Captives. It's written, really, I believe, in the 12th century by Rav Avraham Ibn Da'ud. Interestingly enough, depending on how you do it, his acronym comes out to the Ravid. But it's not the same Rav Avraham Ibn Da'ud that we usually think about. It's someone else. Rav Ibn Da'ud is sort of a rabbinic historian of sorts. And he records a classic story that we know as The Four Captives. I gave you a little bit of the text here. There's some other really interesting parts that I couldn't get for today, but this is what I had saved on my computer in a PDF form. And he tells a story, essentially, that he dates, if you sort of do the Hebrew dating and you kind of do some translating, it comes out to 990. So this is a story. He's retelling it at some point in the 12th century. And it's actually meant to take place some 150 or whatever it is, some years prior, 990. And he tells a story about a ship that left Babylonia, and is essentially carrying a number of very prominent rabbis. The names of these rabbis are, there are four of them. One is less well known, Rav Shemaria ben Elchanan. Another one is Rabbeinu Chushiel. Rabbeinu Chushiel, more important, is the father of Rabbeinu Chananel. Okay? And then we also have someone by the name of Rav Moshe ben Chanoch and his son, Chanoch. So these are the four rabbis. They're sent on some sort of mission, probably to collect a dowry. It's understood often that they were sent as emissaries of the Babylonian yeshivot, although that's not entirely clear. I don't believe in this story. And essentially, as they're off on their mission to go and collect funds, they are overtaken by a pirate. It's a pirate story, I mean, right?
Right.
That those are usually the best. It mentions a particular Muslim king of Spain at that time. If you take a look at the top of page 58 here, Abid Rahman Ar-Rahman al-Nasir. This is, by the way, a translation by Gershom Cohen, who was a trailblazer in terms of medieval Jewish history in particular, and a Spanish medieval Jewish history, a first-rate scholar. His family, he has children who are also very prominent Jewish historians as well. I include he's the grandfather of an old friend of mine that I went to Gush with a while back. He tells the story here. We'll read some of it, and then I'll add some pieces as well. So it says, this commander of a mighty fleet set out to capture the ships of the Christians and the towns that were close to the coast. All right, so he had his own wayfaring mission. They sailed as far as the coast of Palestine and swung about to the Greek sea and the islands therein. Here they encountered a ship carrying four great scholars who were traveling from the city of Bari to a city called Sebastian and who were on their way to a Kala convention. Okay, Ibn Ruhamis, the name of the pirate, captured the ship, okay, and took the sages prisoner. Okay, so here we go. One of them was Rabbeinu Chushiel, the father of Rabbeinu Chananel. Another was Rabbeinu Moses, right? The father of Rabbi Chanoch, who was taken prisoner with his wife and his son. Right, Rabbi Chanoch himself, right, at the time was but a young lad. The third was Rav Shmaria ben Rav Elchanan. As for the fourth, I do not know his name. So this has like a real authentic feel to it, right? I remember most of the story, but there are some gaps as well. The commander wanted to violate Rabbeinu Moshe's wife, inasmuch as she was exceedingly beautiful. Thereupon, she cried out in Hebrew to her husband, Rabbeinu Moshe, asked him whether or not those who drown in the sea will be quickened at the time of the resurrection of the dead. He replied unto her, Pasuk in Tehillim, the Lord said, I will bring them back from Bashan, I will bring them back from the depths of the sea. Having heard his reply, she cast herself in the sea and drowned. Okay, continuing. These sages did not tell a soul about themselves or their wisdom, right? In other words, they pretended they were just, right? They were just regular civilians, not on a certain mission and not having achieved a certain stature, level of scholarship in terms of vis-a-vis their communities. The commander sold Rabbi Nishmaria in Alexandria of Egypt, so he goes there. Bishmaria proceeded to Fostat, where he became the head of the academy. Right? Fostat is what community? Right? Fostat is Old Cairo. Fostat is the community where the Cairo Geniza was found, so it's really, in many ways, the center of the medieval, what will become the medieval Egyptian-Jewish community. And then he sold Rabbeinu Chushiel on the coast of Ifriqiya, which we might call Africa. Yeah. From there, the latter proceeded to the city of Kairouan, which at the time was the mightiest of all Muslim cities in the land of the Maghreb, where he soon became head of the academy and where he begot his son, Rabbeinu Chananel. So that's Rabbeinu Chushiel. Right? So you have Rav Shemaria goes to Alexandria, makes his way to Fostat, becomes a Rosh Hashiva there. Rabbeinu Chushiel, he makes his way to Kairouan, right, the mightiest of all the Muslim cities, and then he becomes the head of the academy, right, the Rosh Yeshiva, and then he has Rabbeinu Chananel. Then the commander arrived at Cordova, right, which we've mentioned as well, right, not a coincidence, where he saw Rabbeinu Moshe along with Rabbi Chanoch. He was redeemed by the people of Cordova, who were under the impression that he was a man of no education. Right, so they say, okay, this is a fellow Jew, we need to save him. So they do. And so he's a no name. Now, there was in Cordova synagogue, and I apologize, it's going to get cut off. I'll tell you the rest of the story. But you're going to want to read it, but I don't have it here, so I apologize. Now, there was in Cordova synagogue that was called the College Synagogue, where a judge by the name of Rabbi Nathan the Pious, who was a man of distinction, used to preside, and so on and so forth. And so basically the story continues as follows, that he was, they brought him into the shul, to the yeshiva, whatever it was, and they put him in the back row, mm-hmm. Mr. Rabbeinu Moshe. So he's sitting in the back row, and they don't know who he is, and the Rebbe gets up, and he starts to lecture, and poses a question to everyone, and no one knows the answer, and of course this, you know, the new guy on the block kind of, you know, sheepishly raises his hand to the back and nails it.
Wow.
And then so on and so forth, and one thing leads to another, and they ask him more questions and more questions until the point that they realize that he is a first-rate Talmud Chacham, and they basically, on the spot, more or less, appoint him Rosh Yeshiva. That's basically how the story ends.
Wow.
Okay. So this is the story. Now, it sounds like it could, well, I mean, it's almost too good to be true, but there's a lot of evidence that as a matter of historical record, it doesn't really work. I'll just give you a couple of points. Cohen, in one of his major articles in 1962 already, makes sort of collects these points. Some of the historical concerns had already been raised in the 19th century, so a long time. Mm-hmm. The story has been known for quite some time, and there's been discussion of it, as well as critique of the historicity of it, really for well over 100 years already. So, for example, this king, this Muslim king, Abd al-Rahman al-Nasir, is known to have died in 961. Story is taking place in 990. So that doesn't really work very well. We also have later evidence from the Geniza that Rabbeinu Chushiel actually came to the community of Qayran of his own volition. And wasn't sold as a captive, which wasn't known by the 19th century or right the earlier time, but that's now become known. And so there's other evidence as well. But there's good reason to conclude that as a matter of historical record, this is not actually what took place, which to me doesn't make it less significant. It just changes the significance of the story. Don't read it as a literal historical document. Are there kernels of truth? Could well be that there are kernels of truth to this. But I think that this sort of focuses our attention on what really the text is all about. And it's very clear that what this text is about is this is sort of a founding myth or legend about these communities and about the transition of our Mesorah from the now declining Babylonian Jewish community to three new centers of Sephardic life. Mm. You have really the major centers at that time. You have the Egyptian Jewish community, Alexandria, Foshat, etc. You have Qayran, North Africa, and then finally you have, of course, Cordova, in other words, the community of Spain. Isn't it true that what we're seeing here is the sort of the trajectory of the continuity of the Mesorah through this miraculous episode, as recounted by Ibn Daud, which God miraculously arranged to have a pirate be his emissary, essentially, to ensure the perpetuity of our tradition. The truth is, Ibn Daud's work is called Sefer HaKabbalah. And it is exactly that. It is a story of the transmission of the Mesorah. He goes all the way back, and he does like Pirkei Avot. He's got Moshe, and he's got Yeshua, and then, right, he's got Nevi'im, and Shekneset HaGdolah, the whole nine yards. And that's exactly what the Sefer is. And it, of course, culminates with and concludes with his own community of Spain. Mm-hmm. He's writing 12th century in Spain. So really, Sefer HaKabbalah, in particular, this story, this legend of the four captives, if not actual historical truth, is sort of as truth in a larger sense, or myth in the sense that we use it nowadays very often. Myth in a really healthy, positive sense, as not myth, you know, something that we discard, oh, that's just a myth, but it's a founding myth. And that's really essentially what this is. It's a founding myth that records the continuity and the integrity of the Mesorah as a transition to the new Sephardic centers. And it's really a document of self-understanding in that way. And the truth is there are many founding myths. I'm going to talk about a Jewish one in a second, but we're familiar with founding myths and that notion. And again, not in a bad way, just not necessarily historical in a literal sense, but that doesn't take away from its significance. Mm-hmm. Right? So, right, Rome is built by Romulus, and we have a whole founding myth of Rome, and so on and so forth. You have this. Even I saw an article about founding myths of Jews coming to Ellis Island. There are founding myths around that. There are stories that cropped up in previous generations that were retold about how the Jews arrived and kept their names and all these stories, and how everyone came there, and, you know, like, that's how the Jewish community, the American Jewish community, started, which is, of course, it's not exactly how it went. Of course, there's more than a kernel of truth to that kind of founding myth, but it's sort of a story of self-identity. It's obviously a different kind of story. It might not be about the, you know, the preservation of the Mesorah, right? It might be about survival and about immigrant communities, migrant communities, and how they stick together and they pull through. But it's, right, it's like Lower East Side kind of community story or something like that.
Right.
But it's but they're founding myths nonetheless, in much the same way. Now, I think this helps to also explain, we're going to come back to another one in just a second, another example of a founding myth, but I think this helps to explain also some of the resonances, some of the stories that we have here. Because when we think about these two primary stories, the story with Rabbeinu Moshe and his wife and jumping into the sea and the attempted rape and all of that, and we think about the story of Rabbeinu Moshe, Rabbeinu Moshe sitting in the back of the classroom, so there are two very distinct, or two or three, distinctly relevant and sort of, to me, resonant stories in the Gemara that echo these two episodes. On the one hand, in the case of the rape, there's a classic Gemara, a very tragic Gemara, in Gittin, and Daf Nun Zayin Amud Bet, 57b, and it's a story that's sometimes retold or studied on Tisha B'Av. And it's a story about 400 boys and girls who were taken captive after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, and there are attempts at rape and murder and so on and so forth, and they jump into the sea. And they actually have a whole Talmudic analysis in which they quote Psukim as a basis for this decision to jump overboard, and then the Gemara concludes in a very positive way, albeit in context of tragedy. The Gemara talks about, invokes the phraseology of Ki Alecha Horagnu Kol Hayom, sort of this mournful trope that we were killed for your sake all day long, as it were. And that is striking. I mean, if you think about it, this is just about one individual woman. But there's the attempted rape. She asks the question, there's a citation of a pasuk in Tanakh that validates her decision to jump overboard, right? There's a lot. There's a lot of overlap there. And then, with regard to the story of Rabbeinu Moshe, it reminds me of two stories. I think there's one that's most obviously connected, and there's another one, perhaps. So here we have the story of the rise of Hillel. Rise of Hillel. Marim Sachim and Afsam Chavav Amud Aleph. They have a story in which Hillel is similarly a no-name. I think I printed it out for myself. I'll share with you a little bit of it. Here it is. So you have it's a story. It comes up in Psachim about them trying to determine a particular halacha with regard to whether the Pesach, Korban Pesach, is Docha Shabbos or not, whether or not you can offer the Pesach on Shabbos or not. So the Gemara says that they didn't know what to do. So Tanu Rabbanan, at the beginning of that Gemara, halachazon it's alma bebnei b'teira. The rabbis at that time, they didn't know what the halacha was. So pamachar chalba asra liopis Shabbat. So one time, the 14th of Nisan, which is the day when we shech the Korban Pesach that afternoon, right? So it fell out on Shabbos. Shachachu, they forgot the halacha. V'lo yadum Pesach doche et Shabbat. Although they had no idea whether or not Pesach is doche Shabbos. So the Gemara says, Amru lahem adam echad yisha alam mi Babel. There's this guy. Came from Babylonia, the Hillel HaBavli Shemo. Is that called Hillel HaZaken or any of that? Hillel HaBavli. And that's like this dismissive, like he's this Babylonian, like, I don't know, you can try. I mean, it's just this like guy who just came. Shashim, but it happens to be Shashimish Shnei Gedolei Hador Shemaya V'Avtalya, but he did some work with Shemaya V'Avtalya V'Yodea, and he might know in Pesach Echaz Shabbos Simlav. So Shalchu V'Karlo, so talk about this. So they called in the, right? So they called to him and they said, Amrulo Klumat Hayodea, new, do you know? And right, do you know in Pesach Echaz Shabbos Simlav? And he offers a halachic argumentation, and then he says, so it is Doche Shabbos. So they say, how do you know? Amrulo Minayin Lecha, Amrulahem Nemar Milavda. But Pesach is a whole sophisticated out there, like, whoa, slow down. Who is this guy? Right? He's Hillel HaBavli. No one knew who he was. He was a zero. He's a no-name. So after this whole halachic analysis and so on and so forth, so it says, miyad. They didn't wait a day. They didn't wait two and a couple of weeks and have like a whole vote. On the spot, right? There was no, right? There was no... there's no election. They just decided Miyad Hoshivuhu Berosh. So that's it. He's a new leader. Kind of like the story with the Riff, right? Uminuhu Nasi Alehem. They appointed him Nasi over them. V'hayadurish kol hayom kulo v'hilchas haPesach. He gave shir the whole day about the loss of Pesach, right? And he even actually, and then he actually goes, says, he gave them some Musar, and he like ran into them a little bit. Like, it's interesting. It's Hillel. Like sometimes we have sort of like one-dimensional portraits of people. And Hillel, he gave him some Musar also, which is interesting. Too. And then there was another story that came up, and he starts quoting his tradition from Shemaya and Atalia. The whole thing, I'm like, whoa, the whole thing is mind boggling. I mean, this is really familiar stuff, right? You have the no name rabbi who comes from, he's an immigrant, comes from another community. There's something that comes up, and before they know it, the guy shows he's an absolutely brilliant guy, and on the spot, they point him to Rosh Yeshiva. It's the same story. Now, there is another story, which I'm not sure it's relevant, but I wonder. It's fascinating in its own right. Gemara and Menachot on Daf Chaf Tadam Abed 29b, and that's a story about Rabbi Akiva giving shir, and then Moshe Rabbeinu appears in the back.
Right?
So this is another story that came to me. At first, this is the one that came to me first, so I'm with Lisa. But then when I remember the Gemara in Hillel, about Hillel, I realized that sounded a little, that sounded closer. So the story of Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu, which is whatever that means. So Moshe Rabbeinu appears in the back, and Rabbi Akiva starts darshing these halachot. And Moshe Rabbeinu has no clue what's going on. No idea. And he's very upset. He turns to God. He's just like, what's going on? This is not my Torah. And then God gives him this very strange answer in which he says, and this is what was given to Moshe at Sinai. And Moshe becomes, he's like happy again. So it's a really interesting story for a whole range of reasons. It just, the whole structure of the story of someone sneaking, coming to the back, etc., that whole episode resonated, but I'm not sure it's the same thing because it's the one who's the genius is actually the one who's giving the shear. Right, it's not the one, it's not the no-name who's sitting in the back, and Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't chime in, and then all of a sudden, it's not a rags-to-riches story in the same kind of way. So, I don't know. I don't think there's this sort of notion of the unnamed person sitting in the back of the shir and something dramatic happening. I think there's probably some meaningful relationship there, but I don't know if it's the actual model for the story. But I think that whether it's related to Moshe or not, but certainly to Hillel, and then the story in Gittin about jumping overboard, to me it's really, right, isn't it really the same thing? And I think what Ibn Daud is doing is he is sort of building up the sense of the tradition of this and sort of the authenticity of this story, and I mean authenticity in the larger sense of the term, by drawing on these rabbinic stories. And he's saying, you know, one of them is the Gemara in Gittin, the other one is Hillel on the Gemara in Pesachim. And so if there's this really like a sense, he's actually literally drawing from the tradition in portraying these stories about the next step in the transmission of our tradition as a way of really reinforcing that whole narrative of the passing of the torch from one generation to another. So I think that, again, the sense of founding myth in the better, in that, you know, the best sense of the term, I think it's not a coincidence that he clearly draws on these stories as he portrays these respective rabbinic personalities. Now, I just want to add one thing in closing, which is that again, as I alluded to earlier, this is not the only founding myth that we have, and I mean even in a traditional kind of sense. I want to share just one other that's really beyond the canon of our medieval Jewish history. It's already sort of the beginnings of early modern Jewish history, but I can't not mention it because it's too good, which is the founding of the Jewish community in Poland. Mm. Right? So what you have here as well is you had a renowned Jewish community. In that case, it's the Ashkenazic Jewish community, which had existed in Western Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years and produced Rashi and the Baliat Tosod and all these greats. And then the community ultimately starts to move eastward, Central Europe and Eastern Europe. And there's the sense, again, of this need for the community to anchor itself in a certain story. And so there's this great narrative that appears in a couple of places. I'll tell you that the gist of it is basically that the question is, where does the word Poland come from? And there's just a lot of versions of this, but there's some sort of story about how the Jews were traveling, you know, empty-handed, not knowing where to go, what to do next. All they knew is that they had to leave their homes because of the Christian anti-Semitism and the blood libels and so on and so forth. And they're looking for a place to go. They had nowhere to go. Just clueless. Just complete vagabonds, refugees. What are they going to do? And there's this petek. There's this little piece of paper or something signed that falls down from heaven when they get to the area of Poland, and it reads in Hebrew, Po-lin. Stay here. Live here. Poland equals Po-lin. And this becomes, actually, I know it sounds funny, but it becomes a foundational myth, sort of the sense that it wasn't just a coincidence, that this was God's plan. And not just this was God's plan, but this is actually the core meaning of what Poland is. You thought, right? You thought it was, right? It was some, you know, I don't know, right? It's definitely, right? Certainly not from the, you know, the Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic, you know, etc. Family, right? This is an Eastern language. This is, right, completely unrelated. But actually, what they don't know is that Poland is actually Hebrew. I mean, this is, you know, again, it's sort of co-opting it for the sense of that it's ours, that there's a sense of ownership, that this is God's master plan, and it's just falling from heaven, telling us where to go. And this is a classic story. There are many versions of the story that are retold. I gave you two that are really great. One is from Agno, and the other from, I call it Y.L. Peretz, but of course better Yud Lamed Peretz. And Agno in 1916 writes as follows, "We did not know," and he records the story. This is, I think, with some liberal literary license on the part of Agno. I don't think he's saying that this is exactly what people retold, but he's, you know, he's writing a novel, so he does what Agnon does. He sort of retells and embellishes all at the same time. "We did not know, but our fathers told us how the exiles of Israel came to the land of Poland." He doesn't mean Israel in the sense of the country, the Jewish people. "When Israel saw its sufferings were constantly renewed, they went out on the road and sought an answer for the paths of the wide world, which is the correct road to traverse to find rest for the soul. Then a piece of paper fell from heaven, and on it the words, 'Go to Polonia.'" "When they came," I mean, you can see, like, Agnon is kind of, like, smiling as he writes it. "When they came from the land of the Franks, they found the wood in the land, and on every tree," I mean, "one tractate of the Talmud was incised. This is the forest of Kachin, near Lublin. Every man said to his neighbor, 'We have come to the land where our ancestors dwelt before the Torah and Revelation were granted.'" In other words, these trees have been inscribed, you know, from Shatius and Maberatius, right? This is like, again, Agnon is embellishing, and he's kind of, it's Agnon. It's reverential and poking fun all at the same time. And only Agnon knew how to do all of those authentically, because he came from it. He lived it. It was in his kishkas. So it was part of him, and he knew its, you know, its warts, its warts as well. So he's having fun, but it's authentic too. "For those who seek for names say, 'This is why it is called Poland. For thus spoke Israel when they came to the land, here rest for the night, Poland.' And this means that we shall rest here until we are gathered into the land of Israel." Since this is the tradition, says Agnon. Right, or his, whoever the, I forget who the protagonist was, or the figure was in the novel, we accept it as such. Right? Since it's the tradition, we accept it as such. Now, again, there's a lot of Agnon here, but he's drawing on a real tradition. Peretz, who was, I think, a little bit less sympathetic to tradition, a little bit, but I think less than Agnon. "At the end of 1891, at the horizon, the famous forest blackens. On its trees, our ancestors carved the Talmudic tractates, which they had finished studying on the road." It's a little bit of a different version of the story. "Not far from here, they stopped for the night. The quote-unquote exilarch said, 'Poland.' And from this, the country is called Poland." This is it. This is why the nations of the world can't explain it, but we can, right? I mean, like, you can't not laugh, but you see what's going on. This is a community that doesn't have its own homeland. They haven't had it for thousands of years. They can't point to Sahel and to a state of Israel. They don't have anything to take pride in. It's been 1,600 years of exilic wandering from one place to another, right? From pillar to post, as they say. So there needs to be a sense that this, we need a land. And you've seen this in Jewish history. German Jews want Germany to be their homeland. These Polish Jews, we're smarter than them. We know better than the Cossacks and that the locals and all those, they don't get it. Poland, this is pshat. It's Hashgacha, it's God, and it's the Gemaras are inscribed on the trees, and so on and so forth. So again, as you don't have to ask Peretz and to Agnon to conclude, this is not the stuff of historical documentation, but it is a sense of, in this case, it's really a sense of sort of self, it's a sense of sort of self-conscious identity formation. I don't know if self-conscious is the word. Sorry. It's identity formation. This is a sense of how we account for our narrative, for who we are, for what this place means to us, how we have a sense of ownership over our destiny, how there's a sense of, with all the struggles, God had something in mind for us. And so we form a narrative. It's just human nature. And we find it at multiple points in Jewish history. That's really very much what the story of the four captives is all about, and I think it's extremely informative in that sense. So this is how, at least one sort of record of how we trace our roots, and from, in our case, to the new Sephardic Jewish communities. And God willing, next time we're going to start our examination of the Spanish Jewish community, which is going to be divided into two segments. The first is known as the Golden Age of Spain. Roughly 950 to 1150, that's when things were relatively good, although imperfect, as we'll see. Didn't always work out, and that was under Islamic rule. And that's going to take plenty of time. As part of that, sort of the conclusion of that segment, we're going to look at the Rambam. Sort of, he's born just before things turn. And then that's going to take us some time. Once we get through that, we'll then turn to the second phase of the Spanish Jewish Communion, which is which is Christian Spain, the Reconquista and so on. We mentioned some of the personalities such as Ramban and others, the Rabbi Yona that we mentioned, and that whole period of Jewish history. We'll start to examine Jewish-Christian polemic in that context, and then ultimately later on we'll circle back to look at the Ashkenazic community in its own history as well, sort of parallel to the Sephardic experience. That's the plan. Thank you. See you next week.